synopsis for the session. The name of the session is Enduring Communities and Educator Participation. And you are in room Capital 7. I'd like to remind you to turn off all your cell phones and that audio and video are not allowed. However, the sessions are professionally recorded and you can view them on the jerem.org website after the conference. And I'd like to introduce the moderator, and Allison Nakamura.
Thank you, Jacqueline. All right, thank you all so much for coming. We have a lot of people on this panel, and we're actually expecting one more person to slip in a little bit late, so we'll get this started. My name is Allison Nakamoto. I work at the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles, and 3 years ago we had this idea, and we received a grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services to do a project called Enduring Communities, the Japanese American Experience in Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and Utah. And this project was conceived as a three-year project with a lot of curriculum writing, working with each of these states to connect the local state history to the history of the Japanese Americans within these states. So it's been a really interesting process. These teachers are going to tell you all about what they have learned, what their students have learned, what their colleagues have learned, and sort of some of the even bigger results that have come out of this. But what has been really neat is to have the experience to work with these excellent people who are also teachers, who are also working really hard to make sure that students are, you know, who are our future, will make sure that this, that they know about the Japanese American experience, that they're familiar with problem solving, they're familiar with complicated issues, and they're able to critically think in order to make good, strong decisions for our future. So it's been really a pleasure working with all of them. And I know that we don't have a lot of time, so I'll have each of the panelists introduce themselves, and then without further ado, I think the first person up is from Arizona.
Good afternoon. My name is Tony Loronia Allen. A little bit closer. My name is Tony Loronia Allen from Sacaton, Arizona on Gila River. No one's here.
It can come out if you want to hold it.
There we go. There you go. My name is Tony Loronia Allen, and I teach on the Gila Indian Reservation where Butte and Connell camps were located. And it's really been a pleasure to be part of this project. I've got a PowerPoint, and these are the people that were in our group up here. Some are here today, some are not. And we started with this concept, which most history teachers do have. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And I think we're struck with, why do we teach? What is our purpose? And it's just been really neat, again, to be part of this project. And we are Arizona, but I hope to blend from all the states. One of our members was Jessica Medlin. She's elementary, and she chose three pieces of Japanese American literature for her fourth graders. Her concept was, what is friendship? We did have to focus on standards, and so these are the items in the Arizona curriculum that are addressed by her project. Another person who is not here, she's in Korea, is Lynn Galvin. And she really started to zero in on Gila River Camp. Main person in her curriculum was Mas Enoshida, who is here at the conference. She also focused on Kazuo Masuda. And she tells us that was really interesting to her eighth grade girls. The pictures appealed to them as eighth grade girls. Lynn also wanted to use objects. And something that really strikes people who visit is the humanity and how people try to have some kind of normalcy in this stressful time. And the fish ponds just speak so loudly. This is also more about Kazuo Masuda, and different people during the conference have addressed redress, and we've learned, I didn't know it certainly, and was taught that Ronald Reagan's words way back in 45 came back to him as president when he was vacillating on whether or not to really join in the redress movement. And when they used his words against him, basically, it kind of nudged him over. Another thing that Lynn was trying to do with her project was just create empathy, not stats and figures, but bring the people to life. And so she used, again, different documents to address that. Personalizing history was her strength. This one up here is mine. It's an eighth grade curriculum. And at the time, I was a language teacher, so I had to somehow bring it into my language. So I was looking at the AIMS standards for essay writing. And also, when we were at the center, I seemed to get the idea that we were to branch out and not teach only Japanese American history. So I wanted to bring in other minorities. So that's why I went to Jackie Robinson, Disabled Americans, and Women in Title IX. So all those are in my unit, so I can bring in other groups that have been disenfranchised. During our project, one thing that I'm always going to treasure is when we did get to go to the baseball reunion. It was so neat to watch both groups, the Tucson men and the Japanese American internees, reminisce 61 years later. And it was like yesterday. It was so cool. One thing in the unit that I hope we get copyright for is TV station footage. After I taught the first year, and one of our audience members is in this picture, Henrietta over here in the third row, we went out to the camp, and we had a small group volunteer the first year. Disappointing to me personally. We were lucky that year that we got the Taiko Project to visit our school. Our kids made bocce that symbolized their culture and also trying to make a bridge to the Japanese Americans from Los Angeles. So those are saguaro sticks from the reservation that we carved and burned. And then the second year when we taught in 2008, we got a lot more participation. So I right there, I see the value in the project. And we got a second school to join us, and we definitely want to make this a continued effort all the time. Mas is in the top left. And I debated on whether or not to include that picture because of the graffiti, but that is why I included it in the end. I wanted people to know that we still have a mission. The article is from some of my students who wrote an article for the Gila River Indian News. And I was just so proud of the girls. You know, they could have blown it off, but they stuck to it. And I'm just real proud of them. It's on one of the kiosks outside, so I don't expect us to read that all right there. But I did leave it, I guess, a little bit too long. Too bad we can't, like, nudge it over.
We can.
Oh, you can? It's cool if you can. Yeah.
Nudge.
Jump start it.
Nudge.
There you go.
All right. Who is an American? That, again, is one of our charges. Who defines America? Billy Allen did a high school curriculum, and his unit focused on the idea of disobedience as an American right. We were also asked to make it local, to engage our students. He teaches a lot of Native American students from two reservations, from the Gila River Indian community and the Thonla Otom community. And so he focused on something that very few people know about, which is a Thonla Otom person who defied the World War II draft for Native Americans. And he did his based on the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and the Gadsden Purchase. So, and again, when we're defining, or why do we teach, some people thought it was kind of like a disobedient lesson for my husband to teach. It's history. So this man was put in prison also for refusing the draft. These slides represent Dr. Leong's college classes. And I can see that she creates very challenging classes, and I think I would like to sit in on some of her classes. I don't know if I'd want to be a student. But she certainly was a great asset to us and made us think and created a lot of bridges for us to communicate with other people. Diversity and democracy. Dr. Leong also has a really cool abiding interest in Native American history, which I really think is cool. And one of the slides, I don't know if it really came through, it's like a touristy thing now. You may see it in the shops on 12th. It's like original terrorists fighting from 1492. Yeah. So she put that in the PowerPoint also. Our oral histories, Christine Smith has done an awesome job along with the high school students, and we've got a really great backlog of videos that people can tap into. I'm hoping we can share them with other states because I know we want to borrow from theirs. And again, these are the videos that we've got. The one that I really hope we do get copyright to use, I don't know if we did, is, again, I mentioned it earlier, the Tucson channel, KOLD, when they interviewed the Japanese American baseball players who beat the Tucson team. It's just awesome. These are videos from Poston, and you can go ahead and nudge it, Gila River. And this is Maz, and he's just been so awesome helping people go out there and take care of the camp. And this also, we thought it just keyed in totally with the original quote, if you forget about it, you're more vulnerable to having it repeated. And we don't want to have this ever happen to any citizen again. Gordon Hirabayashi. Thank you.
I'm Mary Grace Kettner, and I'm from the Texas team. I wanted to tell you about a time once before our children were born that my husband and I kept a neighbor's four-year-old whose mom was out of town. And when we went out to the airport, when we went out to the airport to pick up our neighbor's mom, I was just trying to entertain him. And there was a little grasshopper on the outside of the glass window. You know, you used to be able to go right to where the planes were and watch, so that's where we were waiting. And the grasshopper had been injured. It had a leg missing, one of its back jumping legs. And I said, Trey, come over here. Look at this grasshopper. Count his legs. And so he, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This grasshopper has 5 legs. And I said, yes, this grasshopper has 5 legs. And I guess I thought I'd done my job as a teacher. But in a little while, he came running over to me and he said, Mary Grace, Mary Grace, I found a grasshopper with 6 legs. Well, in a lot of ways, those of us who were in Texas feel a little bit like that, learning about the internment experience. Starting with Crystal City, Texas, is kind of like learning that, wow, there are grasshoppers that have 6 legs, because our camp feels so different to us. We've got 3 members of our team at this conference, Mark Hansen, Salvador Gutierrez, and Linda Odell, as well as her History Fair-winning student, Michaela Palou. Well, when we began to realize how different Crystal City was, we knew, you know, vaguely about internment camps. We knew vaguely about Crystal City, but we hadn't fit them all together. Working at a cultural museum, the Institute of Texan Cultures in San Antonio, I thought I was one of the ones who knew a lot about Crystal City. And our teachers had all read their homework assignment in Tom Walz's great book, The Japanese Texans. We knew that there were Germans and Italians at Crystal City, as well as Japanese. We knew the site had been a migrant labor camp before it was an internment camp, instead of being built especially for that purpose. We also knew that there were South American Japanese and South American Germans at this camp. And many of us had heard that it was unique in that it was a family camp. So when we started hearing about all these other family camps, we thought, well, why are we saying this is unique? At any rate, it was different from the other detention camps in Texas, Segoville and Camp Kennedy. So we made our field trip down to Crystal City. It's a couple of hours south of San Antonio, where the southernmost ones of our group live. And took a tour sponsored by a local historian and scholar. And all of these facts that we thought we knew were, yes, they were right in his story, but somehow it still didn't all fit together for us. We hadn't figured out that our camp was the five-legged grasshopper of the bunch. And it took a while for us to actually grasp that Crystal City had been set up by a whole different branch of the government, and that's getting a lot of attention here at this conference. I'm glad to see that, the Department of Justice camps. It took a while to realize that the women and children of Crystal City had already been at one of those other camps. We didn't understand that the men at those camps had already been held in detention like the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay until they were reunited with their families, that many of them had been picked up far earlier than 9066, but even as early as Sunday afternoon on December 7th. Well, no wonder our camp seemed like such a happy place to people. They'd already put up with so much worse and suffered so much more. And besides, our camp had a swimming pool. It was like the country club of concentration camps. So here we were down in Crystal City, and I didn't realize until this weekend that, you know, maybe it's not known. Crystal City is a town in Texas, and the camp is there. It's not really the name of the camp, as in the case of the other camp. So that's maybe another difference. We took pictures of each other standing in this field of blowing green grass and on the foundation where the Taniguchi family had placed a lovely granite memorial a few years ago. We drove over to the swimming pool, and our historian, whose name is Richard Santos, and a guest of ours, Steve Sano, a Japanese businessman from San Antonio, told us about the anniversary reunion that had been planned there a few years ago among Japanese residents of Crystal City, and also about a reunion of the German residents of Crystal City. We drove out to the cemetery, where Richard showed us three graves, of German names on them, but they were South American Germans. The gravestones were written in German in Spanish with the German names on them, so it was kind of strange. And he asked the question, where are the other graves? We know that two girls drowned at Crystal City. Where are their graves? We know, you know, somebody had to die in 5 years. There were more people who died than those three German graves that we found. So that's kind of a mystery that's left. Then we ate Mexican food at a local cafe in Crystal City. That's what you always do in Texas when you go somewhere. And then we went out to the site where some of the residences had been moved. After the war, all the buildings were sold, and the people could buy them. I think they were $50, they said. You could move them to your house, and it might be a chicken house. It might be an added-on wing of your house, or you might just tear it down and use the lumber to build something else entirely. But he had two residences. They were probably duplexes that had been used as outbuildings on a farm, and they were beginning to crumble and deteriorate. And Richard and some others in the Crystal City area in Zavala County would like to have some funding to have those buildings at least not get any worse than they are and possibly moved back to the site of the camp. And incidentally, I realize I didn't say in here or anywhere, just last fall, the state of Texas also put up a memorial. So there's the Taniguchi sign that has been there for about 20 years, and a brand new state of Texas historical commission sign with actually a more thorough story of what happened at Crystal City. Richard and some others in that county are also supportive of the German families, as I mentioned, who felt left out of the history of internment entirely. If you see Mark Hansen from our group today, he's wearing a T-shirt they gave us that was from the first annual German reunion held at Crystal City. Those people also have artifacts from the camp, tags that were used, plastic money and things like that that were used at the camp. And they feel like they've been left out of this whole story. They just feel like saying, well, what about us? We were there too. Well, all of this interesting stuff to gnaw on, but in our curriculum, we had to find something that fit our state standards, and we were really having a tough time on doing that. And so we focused on constitutional issues. We had three American history teachers. We focused on constitutional issues and civil rights. And we appreciate greatly, all of us, that the JANM does that in much of its program to programming, broadening that point. In other words, we kind of focused on the six-legged grasshopper, even though we are the five-legged grasshopper of the bunch. Our high school curriculum, for example, is a mock trial. It has a lot of interesting activities, philosophical activities, even a chat room kind of activity, an electronic chat room activity where students are discussing topically, of course. But it culminates in a mock trial of the Fred Korematsu case, where the students play the judge and jury and the lawyers and the witnesses and come up with, is this, you know, with the jury verdict, not necessarily the one that actually occurred. Because it's a jury trial, and Mark wanted to include as many students as possible, all the students in the class, he went back to the first criminal trial of Fred Korematsu, not the Supreme Court trial. We have two short units for eighth grade. And this is, I was pretty amazed at these teachers, kind of not knowing what I was getting them into. American history in Texas is taught in two parts, maybe in your state too. The first half of American history goes on up to the Civil War. So I really stuck them with a job to talk about World War II. But what they did is they pulled the constitutional issues out of the internment camp stories. And Linda and Jessica developed curricula that focus on the rights and the constitutional issues, and they have some engaging group activities and photographs, you know, documents, original documents, stuff like that. Our Texas history curriculum is based on one of our state standards. In Texas history, the whole thing is kind of set up so that you get to the Texas Revolution, 1836, in March, because that's Texas. The day of the Texas Revolution and the fall of the Alamo. So that means that in April and May, you have to cover everything from 1836 on. And most people don't get past the trail drives in their Texas history classes. But there is one of our state standards that says that teachers must teach about civil rights leaders, including Lyndon Johnson, Ovita Culp Hobby, James Farmer Jr., and Dr. Hector Garcia. And there can also be plenty of other civil rights heroes that they teach about. So our seventh grade unit, which is one that I created, is based on civil rights heroes of the 20th century. And I'm thinking that in a few years, teachers are going to get in such a bind, they're going to have to teach the whole 20th century in 2 weeks. And I have the perfect curriculum for it. Because we have included a classroom set of cards of 30 civil rights heroes in Texas. And they kind of drawn from all over the state, all different racial and ethnic groups, all different kinds of issues, women's rights, voting rights, and so forth. And each child in the class gets a card, and then there are group activities using all the cards and individual activities where a child prepares this particular kind of report based on one person's activity. There are people like Alvin Ailey, Barbara Jordan, maybe you didn't know they were Texans, John Henry Falk. Our elementary curriculum, which was designed by Salvador, was a fifth grade technology project, which included searching for photographs and creating a narrative for a PowerPoint that the students themselves put together, and then they create the narration for it and read along with it. And it also includes an interview with three camp children, and it's three students in the class who have thought about what camp might be like for a child based on the letters to Miss Breed in the book Our Miss Breed. So we've got copies of our curriculum. I've got some videos of Mark's class doing the mock trial and the video, the PowerPoint that Sal's class created at the Texas booth outside in the marketplace. And we'd love to see you there. So thank you very much.
Okay. we go. My name's Dave Sider, and I am a member of the Utah team. I teach at Davis County Schools, which is north of Salt Lake. We have 85,000 students in our system, and we're the 32nd largest school district in the country. Some things you didn't know about Utah. Utah, which when we started this project, Utah was, I was surprised to find out what a strong Japanese American and how many Japanese Americans lived in Utah. And especially in our school district area and in Ogden, Utah, which is just 10 miles north of us. Our challenge was to gather all the information that we could and to make contact with the local Japanese American community and to preserve as much of the past as we could through as many oral histories as possible. And we did this and also through by videotaping them. And then after we gathered the information, then we tried to develop the curriculum from that and having a really good working relationship with the Japanese American community. We used them as advisors all the way through. Our director was Linda Oda, who is now working in the governor's office. That'll teach me, I guess. I don't know. But she's working at the governor's office now. But she got this whole thing rolling, having she's of Japanese American descent and growing up in Ogden. And she's integral. She knows the community, and they know her. So she got a lot of people on board. She gathered a team of educators from elementary through university level, and with them we took the charge. We took the goals of the JANM and tried to develop from there. We decided as a team to do, like I said before, the oral interviews, and that these oral interviews would eventually be given to the state archives so other people can research and get a hold of them. And we decided not just to capture the Utah internment camp, Topaz, but to capture the flavor of the entire Japanese-American community right before the war, Topaz during the war, and then right after the war, the results, which was a little bit different take. And that opened up a lot of eyes, mine in particular, when I met people and talked to them, especially after the war, the effect after the war. We took a trip to Topaz. I've been there a couple of times. It's not the place to go this week. It's 125. And it's still all desert. And I can't imagine how people live there in the internment camps. I can't, especially in this weather and in the cold as well. But and of course, we traveled during the summer, so it was a little warm. That was the first thing we did. We came back, we set up a schedule for the interviews. We had high school students do the oral interviews after they did some research. And we had college students actually ask the questions, and the high school students did the technology part because they know the technology part better than anybody else. And they were in the process of digitizing and editing and the whole thing. We also gathered from the community letters, photographs. We had two yearbooks from Topaz, from the high school there, which were quite phenomenal. We got as much primary source material as we could possibly get to help develop a curriculum. We gathered, some poetry, artwork, anything we could get our hands on to get a flavor of what it was like. So what was starting to develop was in all of the curriculum, whether it was elementary through high school, we were going to incorporate art, literature, as well as the social justice part and the historical aspect of it. So once we gathered that information, then we brought the community back for another dinner. We ate well. That's why I said yesterday, too, and we did. But we brought the community back, and they gave us their feedback. We really think they kind of helped us prioritize what should go in. And they weren't bashful about it. There was some disagreements in the community, which was really interesting. No open fights, but it was kind of interesting. And you could sense it starting to take shape. Then it was up to the teachers to take the information at that point and start to develop the curriculum. So we have an elementary curriculum, actually two elementary teachers, based around community and Utah history, and then a junior high around U.S. history, and then we had two high school units. Mine was the American history one, and another was the American government one. And we field tested, like everybody up here, we field tested, get our results back, make changes, field test again, make more changes. And I think somebody said it yesterday best, it's fluid. It changes all the time. Once we have it, the key issue that some of you in this room could probably help with is going to be dissemination. Here's the trick to make sure. If it's going to be an enduring community, we have to make sure that it's an enduring community and that these lessons, like so many of us know, these lessons don't wind up as book stops or door stops or, you know, put on the shelf and dusted off occasionally. Oh, I need something. Boom, there it comes. So we really try to make it integrated, and I think all the states did. And the dissemination, we've got some ideas. The web is going to be very useful. National and state organizations, JACL, other organizations around. But how do we get the whole community involved? Well, that's where some of you can come in and help us. If you haven't volunteered lately at a school, now is the perfect opportunity. Seriously, you're the best resource. Some of you, your relatives, you yourself perhaps, whatever. We need people to come into the schools, and they have to say, you know, I can come in and talk about this, because most teachers won't know where to go. If you just make a contact at the local school or whatever, that's the biggest help that you can help us disseminate the information. Other things that I know we're going to do differently is bring people in front of the Chamber of Commerce. We're going to do something, they don't know it yet, but we're going to do something with the Ogden Chamber of Commerce and Rotary. And they're all looking for speakers. They're all desperate for speakers, for crying out loud. So what better opportunity? So here we've got this wonderful resource. You can tell them about the project, come in, and museums. Jennifer Baker, who was on our team, she worked really well with the local museum. We have several local museums in Utah that we can set up. And since Topaz is now basically secure as far as remaining out, not being a subdivision, let's put it that way, anymore, that we can help Jane down there, Beckwith, who is the curator and who is also a history teacher, help develop that as well. I will say one thing I learned at the conference was, you'd pick up one or two things, and yesterday I heard Pat Limerick talk, and she noted in her session concerning the redress, and that was that history really does matter, and that history comes alive, and the activities that all of us have done up here, I'm sure, come alive in the classroom. But history in this case really, really matters, and the only way we can move forward is we still have to make sure they remember what went before them. So, thank you.
Okay. Next, we'll have Rebecca from New Mexico.
Hi.
You're good.
My name is Rebecca Sanchez, and the first thing I want to do is just introduce the members of the New Mexico team who have worked together and individually for many hours over the past few years working on research, curriculum development, doing the real work of historians and doing the real work of teachers, which are both powerful and transformative tasks. So we have Diane Ball. She is not in here now, but she's from Through New Mexico, a high school teacher. Cindy Basie is here with us, an elementary school teacher from New Mexico. She's in the back row, along with Gina Medina Gay, who is an art teacher in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Elikari Lotfield is a middle school teacher. She's not in here. Trish Steiner was our media technology person that helped us pull together some media pieces. And then we've all worked together under the direction of Dr. Lynette Oshima from the University of New Mexico, who's in Hawaii today. But our group has worked together, met frequently over the past few years, and I think as a group we've changed, and hopefully the work that we've created will change the thinking that children have about history and about who they are and about what it means to be a New Mexican, what it means to be an American, and hopefully our students can ask all the questions that we're asking at this conference. I'm going to start with a bit of student work. I think the voices of the students can be the best teachers for all of us today. Oh, this is time, sorry. But we have in the barracks, the government wants everyone behind the wire to keep us locked up away from Americans. But I'm an American. As we set out to do our work, we found in our own research that we didn't have a whole lot of primary source documents, and that was one of the tasks of the different groups, was to find documents that we could use with students. And as we searched and searched, we found that that what remained from the camps in New Mexico, which were Department of Justice camps, were artistic representations of the lives of the inhabitants of those camps. We had drawings and we had poetry, but in those, there was a true sense of what life was like in those places. We also found Dr. Oshima and her trip to Hawaii last summer found some photos that were valuable to us. But I'm gonna stop on this picture. These are some of the art drawings that we discovered. They were done by George Hoshida, who was interned in our state. And you get a sense of the men. The camps in New Mexico had men only. They were the immigrant generation, high status individuals. And you see their faces. We don't have their photos, but we have their faces, thanks to George Hoshida. We have samples of what life at camp was like. Think of the hours and hours and hours when you used to be a doctor, when you used to be a minister, and then you just had hours to fill. Reading, playing chess, trying to maintain some of the cultural practices. They had annual celebrations at the camp. And again, we have some poetry. And as we read these and we learned more and more, each of these things became more meaningful to us. At first, it was just the thrill of finding something, some relic from these camps. And as you learn the bigger story, it becomes a more serious document, a more serious bit to consider in the way we told the story. So that was just to kind of give you a little sense of something that we felt we discovered from the camps that really guided us. But it turns out that in our curriculum, art and poetry kind of remained a very powerful thread for elementary, middle, and high school students. At the elementary school level, we work to help students think about community. What does it mean to be in a community? And we know that kindergartners talk about community, and oftentimes it's so superficial. And so we wanted upper elementary school students, fourth and fifth graders, to revisit that topic. What does it mean in the here and now and present day to be a member of a community, and how do you get to be in that community? And students discovered that sometimes they're born into their communities. Sometimes they choose to be in one, and sometimes they are forced to be in one. And that was kind of a jump start to take the historical leap backwards into communities in New Mexico during World War II. And from that, we had some outstanding examples in our state. We had the internment experience. Those were forced communities, but within those communities, it gets more complex because the men came together and bonded and built friendships and relationships and things to do that was another layer of community, of chosen community. So our students were able to use historical fiction. They used a book by Cynthia Karuhata, and she's here today to discuss, to provide the bigger context and then to study the more local examples. We had the community of Gallup resisting the national hysteria, and they secured life for their Japanese American residents. And so that was another example that our students could say, hey, sometimes people do the right thing, and that's a model for us to live by. In the middle school art curriculum, students were exposed to the cultural differences that exist in our own state. They worked with a master calligrapher, they wrote poetry, and again, they explored the complexity of culture and the powerful reasons to maintain cultural practices, especially through artistic expression. Again, there were the poetry writers in the middle school, and they used photos and the poems to explore the work of historians and to act as historians. And they did writing of their own and tried to develop empathy with photos and poetry. And at the high school level, they went into the deep constitutional issues of democracy and the court cases and what is left, for us to still grapple with in terms of civil liberties. Throughout the process, we were also very lucky. We didn't know who we would interview for our oral histories, because a lot of the people, unfortunately, that were in Santa Fe are no longer with us. They were an older generation. They weren't the young children. But as we went to Los Angeles and we started to meet people and mingle, we met people who were related to those who were in Santa Fe. And so we were so lucky. One of our New Mexico youth interviewed Babe Karasawa, and he's here today. And he gave us some insights about what he knew, what was left from his memory about Santa Fe and his family's experience there, but also about his own experience at camp. And when we showed the children of New Mexico the tape with you, Babe, talking about life at camp, it was so compelling to the students to see a person speaking from the heart about a very difficult time in American history, in world history. And that's been a really powerful piece to the curriculum for all students in New Mexico. We also interviewed a state historian, not the state historian, but a historian from our state, Sally Noe, and she told us about Gallup and what that experience was like in the 1940s and how the community of Gallup at Gallup High School had Japanese American youth serving as student council president in the 1940s and how that was so different than a lot of the rest of the country. And then we talked with an artist, Patrick Nagatani, and he talked about how art has been a powerful way for him to revisit the camp experience among Japanese Americans. And so that interwoven with our work for us individually has deepened the meaning. But I would also say for the students that to latch on to those bits of personal story and personal history has been very, very powerful. This past year, we had the New Mexico Taiko Group visit our public elementary school and do a live performance, and again, to make a very present connection to a vibrant community that is still vital to the state of New Mexico, vital to our understanding of what it means to be a diverse state and to be a multicultural state. And so I would just conclude with the idea that every little piece has had meaning for us, you know, just the act of researching, the act of teaching, the act of listening, of meeting people has been very powerful. And I think that is where the future of the project lies, is making connections and building community. Thank you.
Okay, and then finally we'll have Pam Newman from Colorado.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome to Colorado, if you are from out of state. The Colorado team had an exciting 2.5 years working on this project, and I think what's been very exciting about this is, as we speak, we are getting more and more information on Colorado. I started off writing curriculum for a school district, Adams 12, on the Japanese internment Camp Amachi 12 years ago, and I could find very little. It was just a scramble. And so when we started, we were still like, look, there was more information, but within the last 2.5 years, it has just evolved. There are new photographs being discovered. There's the Amachi Preservation Group has been doing incredible work, and there's much more. The kids down at Amachi have, at the school of Granada, have set up their own museum. So it's just exciting to see the amount of material that's been coming out of primary resources, and it's critical. And we all know why. We've got to get this recorded in history. So one of our first conversations was, what are we going to do with Colorado? Because it had multiple layers to it. Multiple layers when we had Amachi, the camp. We had Governor Carr, who, if any of you just heard Alan Swager speak, or if you're not familiar with Governor Carr, he did stood up and said no to the rest of the governors and essentially to Roosevelt, saying, you know, I can't go along with this. We also had in Colorado a large number of Japanese Americans in the agricultural community that were already working since the 1800s in the San Luis Valley, also along the Greeley, Fort Lupton corridor, and huge farms, and a very substantial part of the economy. And Carr said, these people will not go. And so there's that layer of story in Colorado. So the problem is you can't cover it all. So we had the team, and I will leave up here a list of the team and also a synopsis of our units, if you wish a copy, and our emails and all of that. But our first challenge was, how do we do it all? And the team that I worked with wanted to do everything, and we couldn't do it. And that's the great story of social studies. You can't do it all. So that was our first kind of grappling. Of course, as in all the states, you've heard standards and No Child Left Behind, and assessments dictate quite a bit. So that was an overarching umbrella hanging over our decisions. And so some of the decisions on the content and the approach that we chose on teaching strategies was going to meet all of the criteria: No Child Left Behind, state standards, and assessments. The first thing we decided is definitely integration of the curriculum. This is not an add-on. And so that was one of the underlying threads as we started to make decisions on content and how we were going to cover the content. The other, just to share this with you, this was a whole afternoon at my house, and there were some actual tears and some tension among the writing team, because they truly wanted to represent the Colorado Japanese American perspective, and we're all Anglo women sitting around talking. So that became it was a very good intellectual and emotional discussion. We called in Daryl Maeda to kind of help us out and give us some perspective, and had an advisory board and started working through that issue. But I think it's important to that you know that was one of the pieces that we were working through to make sure that we had an accurate representation. So the elementary program used wheat flour. It integrates art, a lot of literature besides wheat flour, and photography. It is an incredible program, our unit. It was field tested, and I don't have the great PowerPoint because my age doesn't do PowerPoints, but I thought I would bring a couple examples of some of the student work that came through. They had to analyze, and I'll leave it up here for you to look, but they had to look at different photographs. They chose different photographs, and then they had to tell why they chose the picture, and what does it show, and what does it tell you about life at the camp, and what would be difficult about living in this in the internment camp. And the kids had some really interesting comments. Some of them were goofy, but it says, we chose this picture because it's the best one we could find because the living conditions were bad. So they picked the best living room they could find. And that kind of, I think, says something to it. What would be different about being in an internment camp? Well, you didn't have any freedom. You know, very fourth grade kind of concrete things. So they also wrote some comments on the part of the assessment, or the lessons was to write a letter about how you'd feel if you had to move. And I'll just read a couple of them. I would really feel sad if I had to leave behind my lizard, my family, and everything I had. I had to leave behind everything. I would also be mad at the people that made me leave all my stuff. It would make me want to go to the other side of the world, and I would take all my stuff. Every day, I would wonder, why did a lot of Americans back then treat people different? Japanese Americans should have been, B-I-N-E, treated much better. I wish I could have stopped them. Why did they have to be so mean? Why couldn't people just get along? Good question. If I had to move, I would miss my friends, my neighborhood, and I would miss my home. And I'd bring all my stuffed animals and my blanket. They also did some artwork of going to Poston, and they're kind of cute. You can look at these. But the student work, I think, speaks for itself. All the students and the work with the photographs, what I got from this is all the field tests. There were 11 teachers field testing in elementary, and it was very powerful that the kids were really making the connections and drawing the dots and thinking about this, what happened, why? And they were looking at it from a child's perspective. I'm going to skip because of time forward to the high school unit, and I have a couple student examples there. The high school unit looked at CAR, and it also looked at asking the difficult question, and I'm going to read it. They explored the power that the Constitution assigns the majority and the resulting dangers it creates for the minority. And that is a hard concept for high school kids to be grappling with. But I believe we have a field test. Raise your hand. Did some of the informal field testing, and the field test teachers did a great job in high school. But these are just a couple of students' essays. Roosevelt's belief on what Americans should have were great. He wanted all Americans to have freedom. Freedom from want, freedom from fear, freedom from freedom of worship, freedom of speech. In President Roosevelt's speech, he said he wanted all Americans these things. However, after signing Executive Order 9066, he took all those rights away from Americans. He was almost like a hypocrite. Actually, he was a hypocrite. For example, Japanese Americans did not have freedom from fear. They had a sense of being hurt by other Americans. Also, Japanese Americans did not have freedom of worship. They were forced from their temples. They didn't have freedom of speech, and it goes on. So he's talking about his final conclusion was that Roosevelt was a hypocrite. Roosevelt demonstrates hypocritical behavior following the bombing of Pearl Harbor. His response to hysteria involving Japanese citizens contradicted his desire for peace. And the Four Freedoms speech clashed with Executive Order 9066 and urged artists to express their reaction through photographs and paintings. Dorothy Lange, a photographer hired by the government to document Japanese internment, produced pictures of this true effect of the order on 9066. And it goes on. But I think this, kids, I just wanted to share a little bit of that from the students' perspective, because truly that's what we're here for, is to educate our upcoming youth, our students, so in fact, the story is not forgotten. It is remembered all the time. And it is, and we've heard this a number of times in the last few days, it's not repeated. I just feel very strongly about that. Robert Harvey wrote a book on Amachi, and I have a quote from him. Amachi, like the other internment centers, became a stain on the fabric of American liberty. This is a story of innocent people. This is a story of freedom's hypocrisy. This is a story of Amachi. And that's what we're trying to do in Colorado, to keep furthering this. So I have sample lessons, I have student work, and I have all our the team members' names, and I have 10 minutes left?
For the whole session.
Okay. do I have 2 minutes?
No.
I was going to say,
your
wow.
10 minutes is up.
Oh, my 10 minutes is up. See, I did not pass CSAP, our Colorado literacy test.
I didn't see the signs either.
All right, so thank you all so much. I mean, the amount of information that these teachers were asked to learn, and not only to learn, but a lot of it they had to discover and uncover themselves. They had to go out and find people whose fathers were in New Mexico. They had to go through their archives at the Institute of Texan Cultures and see these photos that people hadn't ever seen. And, you know, if you look at all the history that's written about the Japanese Americans, as everybody here knows and everybody in all these curriculum teams knows, it's very much located in California. It's located in Hawaii. It's certainly not located in Utah, Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado. So the amount of work that these teachers did is just, you know, fantastic. And we're so impressed by all of their work. We're so impressed with their work individually, as well as their ability to come together in teams, because they wouldn't have been able to do it without their teammates. And then every summer we'd bring them together so they'd all get together and it'd be this like bubbly, yeasty, all these ideas springing up, inspiring each other. And it was a really neat process to see, and it's really neat to have them here. But I wanted to open up the floor to any questions you might have to them. And because this is being recorded, we'll have to repeat your question back into the microphone before they speak. So does anybody have any questions?
Could I add a postscript? I had a star in my margin. I wanted to tell you that one of our Texas civil rights heroes from that curriculum is in this room, and it's Ms. Sandra Tanamachi. Sandra spent a dozen years or more than a dozen years getting the city of Beaumont in Texas to change the name of Jap Road, and it took several iterations and attempts to do that, and we're just so proud that she has supported us in this project and is here today.
And there she's in the blue.
And she's in the blue.
Right here.
Turquoise.
Does anybody have any questions?
Uh-oh.
Babe.
The laws of the nation, the laws that everybody should be treated according to the law. With respect to us being put into the camps, one of the things that to me, to show how, I call it ridiculous, we got put in the camps, was the military service. Now, the military service of against Germany and the MIS, the war against Japan, I think is a good example of how ridiculous it was for us to be put in the camps. And I'm wondering if you folks consider that, some details of that as a part of process. And then one of the things that I'm hoping to hear someday is the FBI to make a statement about, we've heard that there were no cases filed or anything like that with respect to our behavior, okay, any bad behavior. I would like to hear the FBI says there isn't anything that anybody has. Someday to hear that from the FBI. Then I don't know if they ever make that kind of statement.
Not my impression of the FBI.
So mine's cleared.
I can address the first part.
Yeah. Can you repeat the question?
Okay. All right, see if I can summarize this, okay? Do we include the military service within the curriculum, and do we emphasize that as part of the internment camp process? Is that what you're... Okay. In mine, the one that I developed, I can't speak for everybody else, but it's included. We take the Lost Battalion, we take the 442nd. My little project went from 2 days to over 2 weeks because I wanted to include it. And since I teach at the south gate of Hill Air Force Base, so I military kids are right there, and they eat it up. And I show them my pictures that I took of in L.A. of the memorial and all that, and they'll get some more pictures this next year from here and other things. So it's included in ours. I have them read excerpts out of the book. We explain that, and as well, we in my particular one, we include conscientious objectors who did not go. So I try to do the whole military thing. Referring to the FBI case, I know there's still cases in Utah law enforcement files from the camps. I can bet on it in the archives. They're still there. And the Attorney General, nobody that I know has ever taken a look at them in recent time. So, but it may be something that stirs some memories here in the next couple weeks. So, but FBI, who knows?
One of our several false starts on our video was the goal of interviewing some men from the Texas Battalion as well as some men from the 442nd who rescued them. And it just logistically, the distances in order to interview those people, we just couldn't get it together. But that was something we considered and would like to maybe one day do, or think someone one day should.
Yes, Christy?
Is it safe to say then that in each of your states, this curriculum you've developed is now part of the state's requirement?
No. Yeah.
She's asking, the question is, have our states initiated the task of getting this into the state curriculum? And so people want to answer.
Good.
We mostly mumbled no.
In the state of New Mexico, we worked a little bit with someone from our public education department who was helping us figure out what exists already in the curriculum that's a natural connection. Because some of us on the team feel like the state curriculum is broad enough that pretty much whatever that you can make connections and teach the important things you need to teach if you're a very wise and crafty teacher and you make the connections apparent that exist already in the curriculum. But in terms of having it more explicitly laid out, that has been more of a challenge. Our public ed department says that everything we've written is very much in accordance with the state curriculum, and the standards and benchmarks are being met and addressed, and skills development, all of that is very present. But now it becomes a dissemination issue, and getting schools and principals. I know in Albuquerque, unfortunately, we have public school principals telling elementary teachers they cannot teach social studies until their math and reading scores are improved. And so there's kind of a reluctance just generally with the social studies in our state because of other federal mandates being very restrictive on time. But the teachers that we worked with who field tested, they felt like they had all of the time in the world to teach it because it was such quality work that they were getting. So there, I think there has to be multi-layered approach to getting it to be more widely integrated. It's the skills
of thinking historically, of analyzing primary source material, of talking to people, of doing interviews. It's all of those skills, right? And that's a lot of the, I mean, all of these units are working on those skills as well. But there are two more quick questions, but we've already gotten a signal that there's just one more minute left. So if your questions are really quick, and if not, you can come up afterwards and we'll be happy to answer the questions. Do you have quick questions?
Well, I was actually just going to piggyback on what she said. I always teach this unit, and it's not exactly what Pam's unit is, but I always teach it following the study about the Weimar Republic, Fall of the Republic, and the Holocaust. I have my students write a paper, could it happen here, and then the paper, and we start to determine. And most of the kids are not exposed in Colorado, at least, to any kind of German, Japanese American German studies in grade school or middle school. So there's no state mandate that has to be taught for the opportunities to
I had one. Yeah. One quick thing, as far as Utah goes, we're like most states, it's pretty general in all areas. But one of the better things, again, I noted from what Pat said yesterday, is the textbook that we use, okay, it's the Americans, but it is forefront, it is at the front of the chapter, it is not a separate box, it is well integrated within the World War II segment. Now, does the whole state use that book? No, but at least the 10 high schools in our district do. So that's a plus.
And so just as we learned when we did this project in Arkansas in 2004, is it really is a matter of the networks that are created. So whether it's, you know, Dave is the president of the Utah Council for the Social Studies, for example. Rebecca's in the, you know, teacher ed department at the University of New Mexico. There are hundreds and thousands of kids who go through the Institute of Texts and Cultures each year, you know, and on and on and on. Pam's working with Facing History and Ourselves in the Rocky Mountain region. So there are all of these great, Arizona has all of these great connections with the Arizona Council for the Social Studies through ASU. There are all of these connections that we're trying to make, and this is how we know that it will be successful, because we know that it's through these workshops. It's through going to national social studies conferences. It's through all of you going to your grandchild's school and, like Dave was saying, talking about these stories, telling your grandchild's teachers about this curriculum. This is what it takes. So, you know, it's a very grassroots effort at this point. So we hope you all will join us in our effort. Thank you.
Oh, I posted. I drew. Thank you.